Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, SALT iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io.
When you're trading options, Fidelity has just what you need, with straightforward but powerful tools to help you select a strategy and execute your ideas. And they offer a wide range of information and insights to help simplify your trading experience. Have a question? Ask it live during their small classes and coaching sessions. Need information? Check out their educational videos, articles, and webinars. See why it's easy to trade options your way at Fidelity. Start now at fidelity.com/options.
Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request. Welcome to the On the Tape podcast, Guy Adami, always joined by Dan Nathan. And we have a special guest with us today. Last joined us in November of last year. I think it was the third, if I'm not mistaken, Dan. That, of course, would be the great David Rosenberg. Rosie, how are you?
Starting to sense that spring's in the air. The igloos have melted and the huskies have gone into hibernation, stored the parkas back in the attic. So it's all good.
All good. And your Maple Leafs might make a long-awaited run to Lord Stanley's Cup. But you're an old friend.
I'm a Montreal Canadiens fan. Let's hope not.
Okay. I will tell you unequivocally that the Canadiens of Montreal will not be making a run to Lord Stanley's Cup, neither here nor there. So, Dan, Rosie is an old friend. And something happened to me earlier today I want to share with the audience, Dan Nathan, so indulge me for a second. No, I'm on this Spotify. You know that thing, Dan?
Yeah,
Spotify,
heard of
familiar?
It. Yep.
And I have an 800 now and 65 song playlist, as you've probably come to realize. And something happened a couple of years ago, I think it was, where all my Simon and Garfunkel music went away for some reason. I'm like, oh, that sort of sucks. Also, Neil Young music went away. I'm like, wow, I can't listen to Powderfinger. So I'm listening to the Spotify this morning on the shuffle because that allows songs to play indiscriminately. And lo and behold, I hear Simon and Garfunkel from the Old Friends tour that I went to early in December of 2003. And one of those songs, Rosie, is I Am a Rock. And I am a rock, I am an island, and I've been damn wrong about this market for so long. But you know what? A rock feels no pain, brother, and I still feel no pain, but it's been painful to be short and to be bearish. So let's sort of go from there down. What have I gotten wrong over the last, call it now, since you've last joined us, but much longer than that?
I'm just thinking I'd rather be a bull than a bear. Yes, I would.
I'd rather be a hammer than a nail. Yes.
What have we missed? And what I didn't predict, and I can't say what it is that the bulls got right, except that the old adage that better to be lucky than be good. So what I predicted that in an environment where treasury yields have headed back up and that we've taken out 3 rate cuts since the beginning of the year from the Fed, that we would have had this sort of multiple expansion. Let's just take it a year at a time. In the past year, The S&P 500 is up 30%. Earnings are up 4%. I keep on hearing about how this is an earnings-driven market. Earnings are up. Earnings are up 4%, and the price action is up 8x. So the multiples expanded from 18 to 21. A three-point multiple expansion in 12 months is a 1 in 10 event. And so that's what I called it, the UB40 song, you're a 1 in 10. And in fact, the 21 multiple, look, for you to have gotten the market right, you would have had to say a year ago, look, stay bullish. Earnings are going to be up 4%, but this market's going to rip 30%. And who would have believed that? You know, but it happened. Why? Because this is a momentum-driven market. It doesn't always have to make sense. The math doesn't always have to work. Momentum, psychology, as Charles McKay put it back in the 1840s, it is herd mentality. It is maddening crowds. So there's a lot of psychology momentum behind this. But at a 21 multiple, we are in the top decile of valuations historically. So I don't know what happened to buy low and sell high. And I guess that people would say, well, this year I would have bought high and I would have sold it higher. And I guess that much is true. But that's basically, you know, what it is. The stock market is behaving as though interest rates are back at zero. And as opposed to the risk-free rate being, say, closer to 4 to 5%. And that's what I try and answer. I try just to say, does the math make any sense? And I'm trying to figure out what is the market pricing in? Because historically, when the risk-free rate is 4 to 5%, on a median basis and on an average basis, the multiple is 16, not 21. Ergo, what is the market pricing in for earnings growth for the coming year that would make the multiple make sense? And the market is telling you that they're expecting 45% earnings growth. That is what is embedded in current valuations. 45%, it's not impossible, but it's happened only 3% of the time in the past. So that's a 1 in 30 event. And it usually happens when you come out of recession, not in a soft landing, and not certainly when the economy could be at risk of tipping over at some point in the next year. We've seen this before. We've seen this sort of market before. I saw my good buddy Dan Greenhouse on your favorite show on CNBC yesterday, and I tweeted about it because he said, if people are saying that this is a bubble, don't know what a bubble is. So I said, okay, I'll just call it a giant sud. I won't call it a bubble because I remember when I was in Merrill Lynch and I was talking about bubbles and people got offended. It was like I was saying, your kid is ugly. In our business, guys, we cannot use the word bubble. People find it offensive. They take it personally. So I'll just say it is the top 10% priced market of all time. And so do I really want to chase this thing? I don't. I will never advise my clients to chase a bubble, to chase a mania, or to chase what is the top 10% priciest market of all time.
Let's take a step back here because one of the first things I read every morning is Early Morning with Dave. It comes to you from Rosenberg Research. There are people. A note that you had earlier in the week, complacency, greed, and momentum describe the current manic backdrop market outlook is reminiscent of 2007 and 2000. So what's interesting to me, so the use of the term bubble, Guy and I, we're talking every day on this stuff, and we debate this whole idea. There's this like negative connotation of a bubble that means that if you use that expression, that means it's about to pop. That's why it's on the tip of your tongue. So it means that you are calling BS and you're calling a top. And that's not exactly, because we've all lived those periods that you were just talking about. The real estate bubble of the 2000s went for years. And I was at Merrill Lynch in 2000. What I found in a lot of our colleagues there, okay, the work that you were doing, the things that you were pointing out about this bubble that was inflating was very useful. You weren't calling a top. You didn't have a crystal ball. You weren't able to put your finger on the moment in which it was going to pop, but you were going to give, or you were going to arm investors, okay, with the reasons why ultimately it will do. That's a fact. And then if you go back to 2000, I think we're all a little bit more immature as it related to asset bubbles, or at least people like me, because I came into the business in 1997, Rosie. So my point is, I think you pointing some of this out is very useful. Now, the point I want to make about your valuations right here is that if you think about S&P earnings and where they're all expected to come, they're coming from a bubble in enthusiasm around one theme. That is similar to 2007, and it's similar to 2000. 2000. But if I look at the estimates for Microsoft, the estimates for NVIDIA, even the estimates for Google Alphabet that lags, we're talking 15% at least. NVIDIA, which is now the third largest market cap company in the world, about to overtake Apple, believe it or not, is expected of 90%. So you can back into those top 10 names, get your high single digits earnings growth, right? Have a 21 multiple, and the rest of the S&P seems fair to cheap. Does that make some sense?
I would say that we've done the work on that. And a lot of it came from, I saw my friend Savita from Merrill come on CNBC and say, because they're talking about the concentration in the market, and the view was that, well, this is it's a digital economy. It's not an industrial economy. And so here we have whatever 30% market concentration in technology. And the view was that, of course, the overall multiple is inflated because this sector has been re-rated and it's the biggest chunk of the stock market. I get that. But if you're taking a look, for example, at all the 11 S&P 500 sectors, and you look at their historical multiples, only three are trading at a discount to their historical norm. What are they? They're energy, they're REITs, and they are utilities. And everything else, to varying degrees, is trading expansively, and nothing more, by the way, than technology is. But I would say that there's only a couple of sectors that are on my radar screen that are trading at reasonable multiples. So I would say you're right that not everything in the market is in a bubble, and that's always the case. However, it's not just technology. There's wide swaths of the market that are not in a bubble, but are overpriced nonetheless.
David, I read all the time again, and I'm always trying to figure out how I can be wrong. And as wrong as, you know, as often as I am, it becomes a daunting task. One of the bull arguments continues to be, and this is a historical thing, that cash on the sidelines mantra that you hear all the time. I would submit it's thrown out in a lazy fashion, yet it's thrown out. Is there any credence to that? I'm not suggesting truth, because that would suggest people are lying, but is there anything that supports that argument? You know, what you're missing is the fact that there's all this dry powder waiting to get into the marketplace.
Probably one of the top five most ridiculous arguments to be bullish. If you're bullish, find another argument. Because you might as well tell me that the population is going up every year. Therefore, we got to be bullish because population is going up. Well, whether you're taking a look at how you define liquidity, to me, liquidity is the bid-ask spread. To me, liquidity is confidence. But people define liquidity as cash on the sidelines, however defined. Money market funds, bank deposits, cash under the mattress. But if you look at the history of that line of, say, dollar liquidity, it's always going up. It's always going up. You look at that liquidity, it's going up in every bear market. It doesn't tell you anything. The wall of money doesn't tell you anything. And in fact, you do not need this dry powder to drive the market in either direction. For example, you two guys. Let's say you two guys are all in. You guys are all in the market, but you're selling each other's stock. Guy, you're driving Nathan's stock up. Dan's driving your stock. It's like the pig farmers. You have two pig farmers and they're selling their pigs. Like, you need pigs on the sidelines. You're selling each other's pigs at a higher price. You're bidding up each other. So you don't need to have, you see, it's the most ridiculous thing in the world. You don't have money on the sidelines, okay? You don't have money on the sidelines, but you want to take your friend here. You want to take his stock portfolio. You want to bid that up. So you do that, but maybe buying your portfolio. And it's just a churn. It's just a churn. So this whole thing, I've written reports on it, that dry money is the stupidest argument to be bullish. Even when there's reasons to be bullish, find a different reason. Prove to me that we're going to have a runaway growth in the economy. The Fed's going to cut rates. Give me a whole bunch of other things. We're going to have world peace. Don't talk to me about this stupid. I hear it on TV as well all the time on Bubble Vision about the dry powder, the wall of money ready to enter the market. The market doesn't need that wall of money, okay? And there's no correlation. But it's just nice sound bites to tell people to buy the market. It's actually what promoters use on Wall Street.
I didn't mean to trigger you, but I knew I'd elicit that response. I appreciate it, because when people hear us pine about it, they're like, you're just not paying attention. When they hear somebody of your stature say and dismiss it, I think it carries more weight. And again, listen, I'm not suggesting in the entirety of the people that use it are lazy. What I'm saying is that in and of itself tends to be a pretty lazy argument. So anyway, thank you for that.
I think the people that talk about the dry powder are probably on some white powder. But I think that if you're coming up with a bullish argument for the stock market, find something different. Tune out those promoters that talk about the wall of money and the dry powder, because there's no correlation. You might as well talk about basketball attendance, okay, as a correlation to what the S&P is doing.
This probably will also trigger you, just the folks, if you use the term bubble. If you make a comparison to what's going on in generative AI right now, you are labeled as just an idiot. You just don't get it. It's so different this time, okay? And somebody, a mutual friend of ours, without naming names, prominent strategist, forwarded me a tweet, and I thought it was really interesting. So this is, we'll put it in the show notes. It's from March 24th. It's from a guy named @Kashi111 or something like that. You'll see it in the show notes here. And it's titled, "The Autumn 2000 of Cisco's Discontent." And it's saying, in the autumn of 2000, the Fortune 100 halted capital spending. Alternative telecom carriers disappeared, along with many of the dot-coms that have been so feverishly buying Cisco gear. And it goes on to detail what you and Guy and myself and any student of history and any student of risk asset bubbles knows very clearly. Guy has detailed a couple scenarios with Sun Microsystems. I mean, listen, at some point in the year 2000, somebody jammed one too many banner ads on Yahoo, and the whole thing came crumbling down. And we know what happened, okay? But I want to bring you over to a few prominent tech reads, okay, that I follow here on a daily basis. This is from The Information. This was on March 12th. Amazon, Google quietly tamped down generative AI expectations. We'll put that in the show notes. They're talking about commercialization of these sorts of things, right? This is from The Platformer. This is Casey Newton. This is a few days ago. The indie AI companies are falling apart. The list goes on and on and on. So last year was the year that people were tripping over each other to buy $40,000, $50,000 GPUs to train large language models, right? Before they knew what the commercialization of these were. And then you had people buying the servers, and then you had the server farm. I mean, the list goes on and on, right? And it's the hyperscalers who are benefiting from this, and they're doing deals, and they're investing in the ecosystem. And then the companies that they're investing in are going back and buying their products, all right? We've seen this before, correct? Like, we know potentially how it ends. It could go for much longer this time than, let's say, 25 years ago. But my point is to even mention this, to even suggest that it could be similar, given the fact that we've seen NVIDIA's sales in 3 years go from 12 to 25 to 50 and expected $100 billion this year, okay? And the stock go from $200 billion in market cap to $2.3 trillion. For some reason, that is supposed to be the thing that why it's different this time. Explain to me why that is a bunch of horse hockey, as Guy Adami likes to say every once in a while.
Well, look, I think that we've seen this before with personal computers. We saw it a couple of times back in the early and late 1980s. We saw it with the dot-coms and how that really, the whole technology rollout and routers and cable, and back in the late 1990s. So this is the wonderful thing about technology, is that when you hit an inflection point, say that we've had with generative AI, it creates a tremendous amount of excitement. And what happens is very typical. I'm not surprised about anything that's happened, is the market goes and prices in a total available market that it doesn't really know how big it's going to be, but it prices it in just like we did with all the routers and circuit breakers. It wasn't just the dot-coms, by the way. Look at all the telecom stocks, right? Back in those late 90s, some of them didn't even end up hanging around. Look what happened with Nortel. So you end up building a lot of overcapacity. Look, the internet was real. Even the companies that were real around it went through a 10-year period of pain. Even look at Cisco, look at Intel, look at Dell. These are real companies. You can go back actually centuries that you get this innovation. Look, I would say, is generative AI, is it real? Sure, it's real. Is it a game changer for productivity? It most likely is. And you saw this with the blockchain technology too. What happens is that the markets are not the economy. And the markets will, especially technology, because it's always so sexy and it captures our imagination, is you get a flood of money into the idea. But right now, the confidence interval around how big this market is going to be in the next 5, 10, 15 years is pure guesswork. But the market always, because it's the nature of the market is built at times like this on speculation. And there's a lot of speculation and assumptions about how big this market's going to be, but nobody really knows. What companies do know is that they're getting asked by their shareholders, what are you doing about your AI platform? And it's still different than it was in the late 90s. And what are you doing about your World Wide Web platform? So all of a sudden, you know, I guess I got to order some. I got to order these chips. I got to order these chips. Next thing in the next couple of years is how much of this is going to be sitting in inventory. So I'm saying that there's just the bands of uncertainty in terms of the valuations Okay. I'm not going to debate whether this is going to be a big deal for the economy. It probably is. We don't know how it's going to be regulated because we know that what the dangers, we know what the dangers are. We don't know how it's going to be regulated. We'll put that aside. But who really has a complete understanding of what the TAM, what the total available market is going to be? And I certainly don't. And the same people that love to buy Bitcoin and trade Bitcoin are the same people that are buying into this new wave technology. I am respecting it. But I'm watching it from the sidelines, okay? And I like to narrow the bands of uncertainty when I'm investing my own money. I'm not a speculator. I think that's really the big question mark. I'm just looking at the overall market, looking at valuations, and maybe the term bubble was too strong of a word. I'll call it a mania if that makes it people feel any better. But this is the nature of the business that we're in. The markets shoot first and then ask the questions later. And the question that is yet to be answered is how big is this market? But there's a lot that's priced in right now. The next question is going to be, who are the next players in this game? Basically, maybe we're not talking about NVIDIA. We're talking about some company that's in the small cap or mid cap space. That takes a lot of work. But I would say that my discomfort level is just the band of uncertainty as to how big the market's going to be in the next 5 to 10 years. There's a lot priced in right now.
Well, there's certain valuations that always hold true. And at different times, obviously, things can get extended or things can trade at a discount. But at a certain point, you get some sort of mean reversions. And one of the things that I look at, and we don't have to get into individual stocks necessarily, but you brought up NVIDIA. At one point, this was a $2.3 trillion company who were going to do a little north of $100 billion of revenue. So you can do that price to sales. Now, people will say, well, you know what? Sales are growing at an exponential rate. So that doesn't hold any water. But that's just one example. If you were to look across a swath in terms of the semiconductor index, and you've brought this up, historical norms are one thing. You know, you're trading at a couple standard deviations away, obviously in large part due to that, but you know, there are other companies as well. So you can look at an NVIDIA and say price to earnings, it's cheap. But what I've said, they're completely outkicking their coverage in terms of what their earnings are and in terms of what their revenue are. And that's predicated to a certain extent on 77% margin. So my question in a long-winded way is, when do those valuation metrics start to kick in and make sense and open some eyes?
Well, let me just say, firstly, I'm not a company analyst, but right now, NVIDIA is probably getting a multiple re-rating because of its monopolistic position in the marketplace. So when it really starts to face some serious competition, that'll be the day that whoever is going to break down that barrier of entry. But they seem to be so far ahead of the game. But at some point, like in 5 or 10 years, whatever we call the Mag 7 or the Mag 5 or whatever it is, will not be the same companies today. And that can include NVIDIA, who was the pioneer. But the thing is that these barriers of entry will ultimately be broken. Look, at what point does the trapdoor open up? It's the same trapdoor that opens up all the time when you have a situation like this, and it's when they start to miss their earnings estimates. And they could even miss by a penny. Just remember Cisco missing by a penny in 2000. And that was after years where they kept on smashing through. The day they missed, fractionally, the game was over, and that was the onset of the tech wreck. And they were the bellwether. That wasn't pets.com. So look, I'm not going to sit here. I'm not a market timer. But when earnings disappoint, that hasn't happened yet. When they disappoint, and I'm sure that day will happen, that'll be the day of reckoning.
That analog makes a lot of sense to us. If you just look at the estimates, and we just talked about how earnings and sales are growing at NVIDIA and the pull forward of just so much excitement of an unknowable TAM, okay? When we know that their customers are desperately trying to develop their own chips that are going to be cheaper, we understand it's not just the hyperscalers, but there's going to be a lot of competition. It's coming online. And if you just look at these estimates up 90% in earnings this year, the first quarter is supposed to be up 400%. Year over year. The fourth quarter is supposed to be up 35%. So you see that sequential deceleration. One of those sequential guides is going to be below what a lot of folks think, and it doesn't have to be that much below, and that's how it starts. So again, I'm just giving you that sort of example with some numbers. And you know, it is interesting that the stock is stuck in the mud right now in and around $900 as the S&P and the NASDAQ have made some new all-time highs.
With CME Group's micro-sized futures and options, you can access the same transparency and liquidity of the benchmark contracts with less upfront financial commitment. Diversify your portfolio and manage your exposure with the flexibility of CME Group micro-contracts in crypto, metals, FX, energy, and equity indices. Learn more about what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/micros. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, Salt iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io. Trading options might be new for you, or maybe you've been doing it for a while. Either way, Fidelity is your go-to source for clear and relevant information about trading options. For example, ask Fidelity professionals questions during their live small classes and coaching sessions and learn more with educational videos, articles, and webinars. Plus, with Fidelity's straightforward tools and technology, you'll find it easier than ever to trade options your way. See what's waiting for you at fidelity.com/options. Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request.
I want to hit something here that just pulling it out macro a little bit here. So we have an S&P that's at 5260. We have, which you just said is trading, there's far more rate cuts being priced in than there are currently, okay? We have a VIX at 13. We have a dollar that's rallied a bunch in the last few months or so. We have crude oil that's up 10 bucks in the last couple months. It's at 83 bucks. We've had inflation readings stop going down, right? We've had unemployment start to tick up a little bit. I'm probably missing a few things here, okay? Why are people buying the stock market if we're going to get to a point in the not so distant future where the idea of rate cuts being pushed into 2025 seems like a really distinct possibility? What are you buying right here? Other than heightened expectations for better than expected GDP and S&P 500 earnings?
I think that, as I said before, and I've been studying the stock market for almost 40 years. So I'm a macro strategist. I do the economy, I do the markets. And the stock market is a very interesting beast. Okay. For example, have you ever heard the word FOMO coming out of the bond market crowd? You ever heard a gold guy say FOMO? You ever hear anybody who follows like copper, aluminum, zinc, FOMO? It comes out of the stock market or TINA. There's no alternative. Have you ever heard anybody in any other asset class talk about TINA? There is no alternative. You guys brought up before dry powder. Have you ever heard anybody in the treasury pit saying you got to buy the 10-year note because of the dry powder? You ever heard anybody ever said that to you?
No.
No, because the stock market, it captures our imagination. And so there is so much psychology. And what happens is the price momentum. Let me give you an example. We had clients years ago ask if we could construct a daily momentum model. And we did. And we publish it every day. It's been flashing green since last November. Okay. It's done a much better job than David Rosenberg's gut feel or experience. But we have another monthly model called the Strategizer that we update. And that's really for the CIO, for the pension funds, for the mutual funds. It's a based on 12-month expected returns. And then we roll it into an asset mix recommendation. Okay. What goes into that model? Momentum is one of them, by the way. But so is valuation. So are earnings fundamentals. So is market positioning. Sentiment, which is viewed as a contrary indicator. So that Strategizer model right now is as bearish as it was on a 12-month view of the stock market as it was in December of 2021. So our momentum model is screaming bullish, but the fundamental model is screaming bearish. One's a daily indicator to get in and out. That's for day traders. And the other one is for more serious investors. So what's happening in our strategizer model is the valuations, which are excessive, and the market positioning, because everybody is all in, that's a contrary negative as a sentiment. It's overwhelming the positive momentum, but you see the daily indicator is all momentum. Ergo, this is a momentum-driven market, and you'd be surprised at how important price momentum is. And this is exactly what it is. And so all of a sudden, the reality is it's human nature. What is worse? What is worse than talking to your neighbor? And he's making a killing. He's up 10% in the S&P. And you're just earning 5% in T-bills and you just want to jump off the roof. When I worked at Gluskin Sheff, so I had 12 years on the buy side, a client once told me he actually would rather lose money in absolute terms than see his neighbor make more money than he did.
Think about that.
Do you know that? And this guy was no piker. He was a serious investor. I said to our client service guy, what was that he just said? Like on the way, he says, every client tells me that. They would rather lose money than see their neighbor do better than them. So this is what's happening. It's the maddening crowd effect, okay? It is basically, that's what it is.
David, think about what you just said. That speaks to, and I want to amplify for a second, what you just outlined speaks not only to the stock market, but it speaks to the consumer behavior in this country. Because if you're sitting in your home and you see your neighbor, he or she, come driving home with a new Mercedes-Benz and you think you know what they make and you know what you make, you say, well, shit, how do they have that car? What you just outlined permeates not only the market, but our economy. Again, it gets back to consumer. I say this all the time about the U.S. consumer. I'll never bet against the U.S. consumers want to spend money. They will under just about any set of circumstances. It's whether or not they should be is really the question. And I think you're sort of hitting on things right now in terms of, you know, again, people not wanting to lose out would rather lose and see their neighbor, their friend, their colleague win. That's out there in spades right now.
How do you explain a 3-point multiple expansion? How do you explain that earnings, that the stock market's going up at 8 times what earnings growth are doing? Earnings are doing fine, but the stock market is just leapfrogging it. I'm not calling it, it's not dry powder. It's not dry powder. It's not liquidity. Liquidity is this. Liquidity is confidence. When you talked about liquidity drying up in a bear market, it's just basically confidence. And right now, and you mentioned the VIX, whatever, 12, 13, there is tremendous confidence and you got tremendous price momentum and you're seeing other people getting rich in the stock market. I got to jump in. So at some point, the higher they go, the harder they fall. At some point, because this is not sustainable, the market will do what it did too. It was about inflation. And it was about the Fed. But make no mistake, interest rates are pretty well the same level they were in 2022. Interest rates have not come down. They're pretty well at that same level. So, you know, you talked about the dry powder before. You know, we reached a point where the S&P is up 10% the first 3 months of the year, and you're going to earn 5.4% in your treasury bill. And people laugh when I talk about, like, why would you part with your cash? You're getting 5.4% risk-free. No duration, no capital risk. They'll laugh. Which I remember, remind them, in 2022, if you could pick up 5.4% risk-free in 2022 with perfect hindsight, you would have jumped at the opportunity, but you see that it didn't exist then. This is where, look, just look at the CNN fear-greed index and look how far to the right it's gone on the greed part. That's where we are. Look at investors' intelligence. What are we? 60% bulls and like 15% bears. A 4-to-1 spread. 4-to-1 spread between the bull camp and the bear camp. It's telling you about sentiment and market positioning. But look at, as Herb Stein famously said, you remember him? Herb Stein, he was Nixon's chief economist. Ben Stein was his son. Remember? Bueller? Yeah. Yes. He famously said, anything that can last forever by definition won't. And so something will upset the apple cart. Will it be the Fed? I don't know. They've already talked the market out of 3 rate cuts and we're still going up. And maybe they have to talk, maybe they got to do more like what Waller did and talk them out of any rate cuts this year and see what happens. I'm sure that, I don't think this is really about inflation. I think that, how do you do this? How is it the Fed embarks on the most Volcker-esque tightening cycle since 1981? They shrink the balance sheet, they raise the funds rate 500 basis points, and financial conditions are easier now than they were March of 2022. Like, hello, they're sitting around the mahogany table saying to each other, like, how the hell is the punch bowl still on the bar counter? How is that even possible? Because they do focus on financial conditions, but they're not going to come out and talk financial conditions is basically the stock market. And the only person who ever talked about the stock market openly and trash talked it was Alan Greenspan in 1996. You remember that irrational exuberance. And then he got absolutely impaled and excoriated and never really went that direction again. They're never going to talk about the market, but it's probably more financial price inflation they're concerned about rather than consumer inflation. That's their go-to. And you know what? You can pick any part of the CPI or PC deflator. I can talk about what I like that's low. They can talk about it's a beautiful CPI and PC deflator. You can say, I'm going to X out shelter or I'm going to X this out. And right now the Fed's saying, it's funny how they act because Powell is there talking about at the podium after the meeting, there were some idiosyncratic earlier sort of distortions with healthcare and auto insurance, so on and so forth. And then you have Waller come out yesterday and say, these inflation numbers are just terrible. Maybe it'll be interest rates. Although I'm a bond bull, maybe rates have to back up here. Or maybe there's just so much earnings growth priced in. The next round of earnings that come out for Q1, we'll see what happens and maybe there'll be disappointments. But these multiples, let's just say, as I said before, the normalized multiple in the interest rate environment we're in is 16. Okay. And right now we're at 21. You know, as the market continues to fly in my face, I got to tell you something. All I'm doing, I'm looking at the S&P 500 and I feel like I'm a kid in the circus and I'm watching the clown blow up the balloon. He's just blowing. The balloon's getting bigger and bigger. And I think that we don't want to call it a bubble, but you can see, come on, guys, look at the VIX, look at the investor intelligence poll, look at the valuations. And so something will happen. Something will happen that will knock the complacency out of this market. And believe me, you do not want to do the math, no matter what your earnings estimate is on what a mean reversion of the multiple is going to look like for the price level of the S&P.
On March 26th, early morning with Dave, you put out the definition of a stretched market and used the term stretches when the S&P gaps 14% or more above the 200-day trend line. That is extreme. And that's where we found ourselves for quite some time. And you know, you put out a number of sort, I want to say superlatives, but a number of different points to back all this up. We'll put it in our show notes. But you know, I want to go back quickly. I think you and I agree on a lot of things. My inflation concerns are probably a little bit more, I don't know, dug in than yours. But what do you make of, is the move in soft commodities specifically, you know, we look at cocoa and some of the other things, some of the grains, copper's moving. I don't consider gold a commodity because it really doesn't have an end use. Obviously, gasoline. Does that concern you in any way? Or is that just a function of what's been a dovish Fed now for a period of time?
We went through a period where a lot of these commodity prices were coming under downward pressure. And now we've seen some supply issues hit. What are you going to do? Cocoa. So what are we supposed to do? Like forecast weather conditions in Africa. The commodities and the same thing with the energy complex right now. Look, the reality is that, you know, based on the oil gurus, we were supposed to be north of $100 by now, right? You know, you have a couple of wars going on globally. Why isn't oil? Okay, so oil's crossed to WTI is over 80. It's no longer at 70. It's supposed to be at 100 by now. People don't forget that really these commodities bounced off the bottom indeed, but they're just really in the range they've been in for the past couple of years. And oh, look, my friend Peter Bookfar writes about this every day. Okay. Yeah, commodities are off the low, but they're really in the overall scheme of things, really just in the range of where they've been over the course of the past couple of years. Is anything really okay outside of like cocoa? Okay, so basically, you know, what can I say about that? You know, find a substitute. But that's a supply situation. It's not anything to do with the Fed. What does anything here have to do with the Fed? I read, for example, that the Fed made some big mistake. The Fed made some big mistake. The Fed made a big mistake at the FOMC meeting. Why did the Fed make a big mistake? They raised their GDP forecast. They nudged up their inflation forecast just for this year. And they didn't do anything with the dot plots, which is ridiculous because they did. We're just basically one vote away from getting to 2 instead of 3. But like, who cares? Who cares what they did with their GDP forecast? Who cares? This is not like one person. This is a committee. It's a median of what, 19 people. So people think, oh, well, look what the Fed did. It's 19 forecasts. They didn't really do anything. And then those numbers are going to change by the summertime. But I'm hearing that people say, oh, the Fed let the cat out of the bag. What did they do? They didn't touch rates. They're saying that Powell sounded really dovish at the podium. No, he didn't. It was just perfectly balanced. Strip out shelter in this ridiculous way that it's constructed. Inflation's already down to 2%. They got the funds rate 5.25, 5.5. Real rates are very high. And I say right now, yeah, I'm surprised that the stock market has done as well. And the credit market, which is basically credit markets price for like no defaults, but we're actually starting to see defaults. Basically, it's the Wile E. Coyote market. But be that as it may, I don't think any of this has to do with the Fed. I think the Fed right now is basically on hold. I think Torsten Slok, I'll tip my hat off to him because he was early saying the Fed's probably going to be on hold this year. When he said that, because I thought the Fed was going to be cutting. I would never thought they were going to move in March or necessarily go six times. But I thought that actually, I just looked at the history that once they stop tightening, which was July, usually within a year, they start the easing process. Everything else in this cycle is probably going to be different.
Rosie, but I got to push back on something here. So if you think inflation is really at 2%, not 3%, okay? And if you think that it doesn't matter that the Fed in December was expecting 1.4% GDP growth for 2024, and now they're expecting 2.1%, and then you just said that you think that rates generally, then they're too high, right? If that spread between really what the real inflation number is and where Fed funds is, then they're probably right where they should be because the economy is actually outperforming, supposedly. And we have full employment and all this sort of stuff. So help me square that, because that's what I hear back from folks. Because right now, investors buying stocks in mid to late December and then obviously into early January were clearly thought that they were going to be able to drop the mic and start easing for all good reasons. You know what I'm saying? And so now, the fact that rate hikes are basically priced out of this year, they're still buying stocks and they're buying them at a much more expensive level, predicated on the belief that the economy is just fine.
It's not always about the economy, right? The economy was just fine in 2022. And in the first 10 months of that year, the stock market was down between 20 and 30%. What was wrong with the economy in 2022? Well, I guess we had inflation. Sure, we had the Fed. But there's no recession in 2022. 2018 was a pretty bad year for the stock market. What was wrong with the economy? It's not always about the economy, right? There's valuations, there's sentiment, there's market positioning. There's a whole bunch of things that drive the stock market at any particular point in time. Right now, I don't even know if it's about the Fed. It's just about the price momentum. And I guess you'll say what breaks it. And we only know from the past at some point something is going to break it. And who knows what it's going to be. That's just the nature of the markets. It's a malevolent beast. The stock market is a malevolent beast. At some point, whatever is priced in, and there's a lot priced in, is not going to come to fruition. Maybe all the three rate cuts come out. I think that's a strong possibility. And they're thinking, if we already took out three cuts and the market's still surging, maybe we take out another three cuts. Maybe the Fed's going to start raising rates again. But it's different. I'm not a big inflationist. I don't know. What is it like? The U.S. economy is not that big a basket case. We are not an inflation-prone economy. Like, where does this come from? People have their head in the 1970s. Really? So tell me, the America, the Pilots Union and Starbucks and the... Where is the labor power? Where are these big, the wage settlements that we got, they lasted for about a year. What are we hearing all the big wage settlements now? Like, inflation's gone from, so you went from 0 to 9 to 3. And I don't care about the last mile, the 2%. Really, we're going to kill ourselves between 2 and 3%. By the time we got to 3% inflation, do you remember, by the way, 2008? 2008, everybody's talking about the global decoupling, that China double-digit growth. Oil's approaching $150 in the summer of 2008. Inflation almost got to 6%. By the time inflation got to 3%, Bernanke had cut the funds rate like 400 basis points. We weren't even at 3% yet. Do you know, by the time we got to 3% inflation in like 84, how far Volcker, the anti-inflation dragon slayer, do you know how far the guy cut rates by the time he got to, God forbid, 3% inflation
in the 80s. All right, Rosie, but let me push back, because I'm not one of these huge inflation folks, okay? But I want to say about 2022, the stock market was pricing in higher inflation, higher rates, and had an earnings recession. So it made sense that the stock market sold off in 2022, right? And so when I think about what's going on now, what could be the thing that causes another sort of 2022 pullback in U.S. equities, it could be that notion right now. It's not different than what you just said, this decoupling from China. That is going on. And I just want to say two things. Two of the largest companies about a year ago in the S&P 500, Apple was one of the largest and Tesla was in the top five. They both get 20% of their sales from China very important. And they, one of them is down 15% from its recent all-time highs. That's Apple. And the other is down 30% on the year. It's been cut in half, which is Tesla, because of China also, right? So when you think about what is the thing that has the potential to cause a lot of U.S. multinationals to go back into sort of negative earnings growth, to me, it would be China. We just had a bunch of U.S. CEOs over there meeting with President Xi. A lot of the stuff that came out of it was not particularly good. And it looks like a lot of gaslighting and the like here. We don't even have to talk about the geopolitics aspect of this, right? So talk to us about China. And does that have the potential to be that thing? And, you know, we could talk about the property markets and the commercial real estate and what it means for their banks. There's just a lot going on over there. In past cycles, it would have been the thing. And think back to 2018, when the stock market sold off 20%. That was largely because of global growth fears back then. So right now, U.S. companies don't care about global growth unless you're Apple or Tesla.
I guess what we have to identify is what a possible surprise is going to be. I think that everything we're talking about, we know. And we know that China is in a real mess, despite the smiling faces from Xi Jinping. And their property market is not stabilized. Neither has their banking sector. And I'm thinking about what could be a trigger. Could come from the currency market. As dollar yen goes 151, 152, and that feeds right back into China's competitiveness. And the question would be, so here's one surprise that would be a global surprise, would be a yuan devaluation, right? Just remember what that did in 2016 before Brexit. So that would be, when you're talking to me about China, what's on my radar screen is the currency. And that would have global ramifications.
Yeah, I think that was August of 16, if I'm not mistaken. And yeah, obviously right. The markets didn't react.
I think it was earlier. I think that, remember that a lot of the outflows were starting at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
And remember that, as far as the Fed's forecasts are concerned, I think Janet Yellen was penciling in 3 rate hikes for 2016. And we threw that out the window. That could have some serious repercussions. Look, there's other things going on, right? Do we believe in global decoupling? I don't. Okay. And I didn't in 07 when I was at Merrill, and I don't today. UK is in recession. Germany's in recession. Japan is flat. China is in a whole lot of pain. Canada is basically in a real per capita terms, because you can camouflage the economy with immigration and 3% population growth. The economy is running 1%, negative 2% real per capita. Canada is basically in some form of recession. The U.S. is going to be an oasis of prosperity for how long? So you see, there's something else going on here when I talk about the currency markets, which is what happens if we get a runaway U.S. dollar? A runaway U.S. dollar, why? I guess the U.S. will never print a negative quarter of GDP again. It'll only happen in Europe. Or it'll only happen in Japan, or it'll only happen in Canada. It will not happen in America. We won't let it happen. There's increasing parts of the world that are actually entering into a technical recession, okay? So the Bank of England's going to cut rates ahead of the Fed. The ECB is going to cut rates ahead of the Fed. You already had the SNB cut rates, okay? These bulk large in the DXY. And the Fed right now, after that Waller speech, the Fed could not be doing anything this year. Thorsten Slok, I will tip my hat off to them. And these interest rate differentials will cause the U.S. dollar to surge. By the way, the breakout may already be starting. Now, what is that going to mean for emerging markets? Not good. And what is that going to mean for U.S. export competitiveness and for the earnings of multinationals, the large caps that derive a lot of their revenues abroad? Not so good. That might be where the financial tightening that the Fed's waiting for to happen may well happen through the currency market. And that could be one of the principal risks that upsets the apple cart, is a runaway dollar.
I'm going to sort of amplify and ask. So earlier this month, I don't want to say it was a mea culpa. That's not what you did. But you said, listen, there was no excuse. There's no excuse to basically miss what's going on the U.S. side. But just so we're clear, you've been very bullish in Japan and other markets as well, India being one of them. And that's been very correct. That was out there earlier this month from you. I agree with you in terms of the currency thing. And I'll go back to Japan and say, I want to get hyperbolic here, but you're starting to see what has the earmarks of a bit of a currency crisis. Bank of Japan raised rates for the first time in 17 years, albeit a very slim amount, but they watched their currency actually weaken on the back of that. And we're sitting here today, dollar yen's north of 151. And I'm telling you, although we wouldn't know it here, I think red lights are flashing in some places in terms of what a weaker yen could potentially mean and what the Bank of Japan may have to do to defend their currency. Quick thoughts on that.
Well, the Ministry of Finance, they're discussing right now, they'll probably do a round of intervention. But the question is, that's always just a Band-Aid solution. I don't think that the BOJ is going to tighten policy again. I mean, I think that one of the reasons why the yen sold off was even though, because they did the expected, everybody expected them to move out a negative interest rate policy, but they weren't expecting the dovish guidance. And we live in a world now where it's what the central banks say, okay? That's why what's more important, the announcement at the Fed at 2 o'clock or what Powell says at the podium at 2:30, everybody knows what he says at 2:30. So the guidance out of Japan. This is important for China. And we could get into a global currency war starting in Asia, as if we haven't seen that before. But that ends up tightening global financial conditions. Okay. That's really, I think we're onto something here. And actually, I'm going to have to start writing about it because it just started to germinate as the three of us were talking. That is, I think, where the apple cart could get upset. And a stronger dollar, especially from these levels, would be a problem for the global financial markets. And so that's something to keep an eye on, absolutely.
Listen, Rosie, we've gotten a lot of good stuff from you today. I hope you didn't mind the pushback. We could not have this podcast listed as the Three Bears. We get that a bunch. Danny's on vacation this week, so he would have been here. It would have been the Four Bears. And I just want to reiterate something. I remember reading that email that came across a few weeks ago, and you've always been straight. You talk to the people in your daily writing like you're sitting across the desk from them, like the respect that you would give to any institutional client that you have. And that's one of the things that I find really valuable about the product that you guys put out there every day. And I also think it was interesting in that note, you talked about how some of the models that we have are doing this, that, and the other thing. They're all accessible here. And so oftentimes when you're giving your point of view based on the inputs that you're using and the like, you're going to get it wrong. But by the same token, and Guy just mentioned this, goes back to I am a rock a little bit. It's just like there's some folks, as you call it, they go on bubble vision and they talk out of both sides of their mouth, whether the market's up or whether the market's down. And I can never really figure out where they are. And that's the point. They don't really want you to ever know that they're anything other than structurally bullish, right? And so the world that we come from a little bit, that's not particularly helpful. So one of the reasons why we love having you on here, we got an hour of your time. We got to go through a lot of these arguments, not be a bit of an echo chamber, but push back a little bit. So we really appreciate you coming back on the pod and laying it all out for us, David.
I really appreciate that. I just want to say that in the world of baseball, I'd be on Billy Beane's team, okay? I'd be a classic Oakland A's because I bunt for singles. I don't swing for the fences. And it's 100% true. I will never make you a killing. But in my 40 years in the business, nobody has ever blown up on my watch. And if that's written on my epitaph, I'll be perfectly fine with that.
There's going to be more than that, David. You're a legend in our world, and we appreciate you spending time again with us. I think, Dan, and I don't know if exact, I think this is David's third time, if not fourth. So we're fortunate that you spent time with us. Thank you, David.
You too, guys. All the best, and have a great long weekend.
Thanks, Rosie.
Thanks again to our presenting sponsors, CME Group, iConnections, and FactSet. If you like what you heard, make sure you hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show, and we also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com. Derivatives are not suitable for all investors and involve the risk of losing more than the amount originally deposited and any profit you might have made. This communication is not a recommendation or offer to buy, sell, or retain any specific investment or service.